Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Sans Pants Radio. Face it, Tiger. You just hit the jackpot.
Hey guys, it's Carney here.
And Damo.
We're taking the show on the road.
Because some cities just need a live show. Movie Maintenance is coming to the Harbour City for a live fix.
Join Gabe, Handsome Tom, Drob and myself for our first show outside of Melbourne.
It's on Thursday the 16th of November at Knox Street Bar in Sydney.
Find tickets by going to trybooking.com and searching for Movie Maintenance, or just hit us up online and we'll let you know where to go. Cheers. Welcome to this week's episode of Movie Maintenance, where some movies just need pitching. I'm Carney.
I'm Damien.
I'm Greg.
And this week is The Abominable Snowman.
That's not easy to say.
It's not. That's my first problem. That title's shit.
But really it's so iconic.
It's interesting because I feel like the actual creature in mention is more iconic than the film.
Sure.
Which is not something that you probably say. Like when you mention Dracula or Frankenstein or the Mummy, you go, oh, the films. But when you say the Abominable Snowman or the Yeti, people are like, oh, that monster.
Yes.
That's probably out there.
Yeah, they're not thinking of the movie that's related to it.
Yeah. I don't think anybody's seen the movie.
No.
Like, it was hard to track down.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
So it came out in, I think it was 1954.
Yep.
It was one of the earlier Hammer films. And it was kind of before they went sort of more studio-based, which sort of came about because they, you know, made a bit of money from, particularly I think from The Curse of Frankenstein was the early one that they profited from.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, moved into making a shitload of Dracula stuff and Frankenstein stuff. And yet The Abominable Snowman never got a sequel.
Never got there.
You just got to wonder why.
Yeah.
It's probably because...
Do you have to wonder why?
No, having seen it, no.
No, yeah.
Look, I'm a big fan of the mountains, as you know, Damo. Yeah. And some of the listeners are probably sick of hearing about.
Yeah.
So I found a little bit of quality in it.
And like we said, like because this is before they stuck to the studio stuff, like some of the aerial shots were genuinely fantastic, especially for that time.
Yeah, definitely.
You were saying they did that in Italy, is that right?
Yeah, I think Italy or France or what were you saying, Greg, in the Alps
there?
Yeah,
in the Alps somewhere.
Yes.
It's meant to be the Himalayas.
Well, just like, and geez, this is the one that kind of blew me away while I was watching it. They go to the monastery, they meet the Lama, and you go, oh yeah, there's an old-looking Tibetan man. He doesn't at all look like he's completely white. And I've looked him up since. I think his name was Arnold or something like that. And he's German. Born in Germany, but grew up, you know, acting in London. Yeah. That's terrible casting.
Yeah, that is so bad.
He's definitely German.
Yeah.
You listen to him speak and he's like, yes, there's some things over there.
Like, wow, an authentic Tibetan accent.
Yeah. That was shocking.
That was terrible. If you tried that these days, holy shit.
Oh, like, you would get killed. I feel like they have that shield of it being in black and white, and so you can kind of hide, I guess, skin tones in some areas.
Sort of,
but
lost,
like,
jeez,
that's a fuck up.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
It's terrible.
Oh, yeah.
He's a shit character too.
he's terrible.
I don't know what the fuck was going on with him.
I think he was just meant to be overly mysterious.
Is there a point in it, though, where our mate, you know, Foxy, that character we love, he's the best, he comes in and tries to talk to the Lama, and the Lama's in like this, you know, this fix.
Deep trance.
Yeah, this trance. Is he connected to the snowman?
That's what I picked up on.
Yeah.
It's like, there's definitely something going on there. He's controlling them.
Right. I think, he's somehow connected to them, and then maybe he's influence their actions and how they're attacking the guys up on the mountain, because he doesn't really want them on that mountain.
Yeah.
Like the whole time he was telling them about how dangerous it was, how, you know, it's not a good
don't
idea.
Don't go.
Don't go, yeah. He even tells the wife,
not,
you
don't
know,
go.
Don't go. He even tells the wife when she's like scared, he's like, yeah, you should be scared. It's really dangerous.
Yeah.
Like they're probably going to die.
He's not reassuring at all. Like no. I can see why she goes up there. She mounts a mission. It's actually pretty good because
I've got it. He's their lookout.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
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 Absolutely.
He's the gatekeeper.
So you think that the llama told them that he was coming? I'm just putting my hand to my head like Professor X, because I assume that's how it works.
You're using your mind powers.
But do you reckon he warned
the Yetis? Yeah, goes into a trend, has a chat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
FaceTime.
He's like, by the way, there's this guy named Tom Friend, and he's on his way up. Just give him a friendly welcome.
Can we talk about the name Tom Friend while we're at it?
It's terrible.
So because the main guy keeps talking to Tom Friend and uses his last name as his name, so he'd be like, all right there, hold on there, friend, rah, 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 rah. So when he's angry at him, I'm like, why is he calling him friend if he's pissed off?
Yeah.
It's just like character naming 101. Like, what the fuck were they thinking?
Yeah. And then to use it so often.
Some of the names were in place because this was a radio play. So what Hammer did initially, Hammer would take successful, or in this case, not particularly successful radio plays and produce them as films.
Right.
And I've looked into it because I was keen to actually listen to The Abominable Snowman. There was never a recording of it. It was really weird.
Okay.
Like it played on the radio, and the really in-depth Wikipedia article that I read mentioned that like quite a few, like a lot of people listened to it, because this is back in the day when, like, you know, if you had a radio, you were going to listen to whatever they were going to put on.
Yeah,
like,
what you only had one.
There wasn't Netflix and 10 million different channels to watch stuff on.
Yeah.
But yeah, like apparently a lot of people listened to it. It got okay reviews, but there's just no recording of it, no record of it.
Yeah.
Peter Cushing played the character. They played John Rollison in the radio play. But they changed a couple of names, but they kept Friend for some reason.
Terrible. Well, it's interesting you say it's a radio play, because as I was watching it, I quite often thought, they're telling us a lot of the action that we're currently seeing. So, like, when the monkey breaks out of the cage, or the Abominable Snowman frees the monkey from the cage, they're like, oh, look, its door's all twisted. And you're like, we know it's twisted. We can see it's twisted. Oh, there's footsteps over here. Oh, they might be 7 feet long or whatever. And we're like, you're literally telling us what we're seeing. Like, that's that's the last thing you should be doing in film.
Yeah.
So you think they just sort of took that radio play script?
I don't think they edited the script at all. Like, honestly, rewatch it. And
he wouldn't have to relearn his lines or change anything. It'd just be like, I've got this.
Yeah.
He was fantastic. Peter Cushing.
Oh, my gosh. What a joy to watch.
Oh. This happens a lot. You watch a film or something, and there's just one actor who's just so far above everybody else, and it's actually a pleasure to watch.
Yes.
Like, it made me... I got to the end of it, and I went, despite the flaws in this film, I really want to watch more of the Hammer films, because Peter Cushing's in quite a few of them. Like, he plays Van Helsing, comes up against Dracula and things like that.
Yeah.
I want to watch that, and I probably will now, and he's so good.
Yeah.
I can't believe it.
I don't... Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, he's generally an interesting guy to look at, but there's also just something about that. I mean, it's that old manner of speech that they have.
Yeah.
It's so engaging. You can't stop listening to it.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know. There's something really cool about watching like a really good actor maybe deliver like and exceed some bad dialogue.
Yes.
Like I've witnessed it firsthand when Greg performs my shitty lines. But it's like, oh, I couldn't believe it. He's so far ahead of everybody else. Now, the guy played, I can't remember his name, the guy played Tom Friend in it.
Yes.
Because he was the headline act, basically.
Yeah,
because I think this is Peter Cushing's, like, sort of earlier Hammer film work before he became, like, the star for their studio, basically. Yeah. So this, Forrest Tucker, that's his
name. Forrest Tucker, that's it.
Forrest Tucker was, like, the lead guy. And he got critically panned.
Right.
People are just like, he is just shit. Yeah. One review I read was kind of like, Forrest Tucker may be quite good at a great many things. Acting is not one of them.
I love how tame that is by today's standards.
It's like a gentle, like, oh, there, buddy.
Yeah.
Nice try.
Little let down.
And what did you think of his character? Like his motivation?
Oh, I actually quite liked it. I saw some parallels to Carl Denham in King Kong, who I borrowed from quite liberally when I was doing Hopkins in Dracula.
Yeah,
I really like that character. Mm. And it's similar to what we saw in Creature from the Black Lagoon, where you've got these two opposing forces. So it's great to watch.
Yeah, they're almost companion movies in that sense.
Yeah, I'd watch them as a double feature or something.
No worries.
Yeah.
You could tell his motivation, but some of the others' motivations, okay, what were they doing there? Why have they gone along?
Exactly, yeah, like this is a dangerous situation.
He was the only one that was like super clear.
Super
You're like, he's motivated by capturing the creature and making money.
But even then, he kind of turned around and when he was like, you know, sorry for getting worked up, and he told him how he basically wants to give people hope or even just an understanding that there's another side of humanity out there.
Yeah.
And I really loved that. I thought that was really great. I mean, he was quite, he delivered that line at least quite genuinely.
Yeah.
And you kind of believe it. You're like, yeah, this character, yes, he says, I'm not going to lie. I want to make money off this. Mm-hmm. But I also want to show the world that there's more out there.
That's a good point because, and again, this isn't another review that I saw for this film. One of the reasons that people thought maybe it didn't catch on was because it was actually, and I don't know if we'll agree with this, but a little too deep. There were ideas brought up in it that were not typical of a Hammer horror film.
Oh, for sure.
And so people were kind of like, this isn't what we want to see, because it is interesting that you have a movie about a monster and you have these people going up against it and they've got weapons and stuff and you don't see like an actual fight scene or you don't see the monster get burnt alive or destroyed at the end or something.
You don't even get to see you get shot. You hear a gunshot from inside the tent or whatever, and all of a sudden, I think I shot it.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
And then when they go down to see it, they're like, look at its face, and it's behind a rock. And that's the way they framed it, and we can't see it.
We've got an arm out or something like that, and he's like, its face.
It's...
And then you're, okay, well, I want to see the face now.
I think like the costume designer was so happy with that hand because that's pretty much all we see for most of it.
When it comes into the tent, holy crap, are those big nails? Oh, it's beautiful.
We talked about this when we did
Creature. I love how it's just going for a rifle.
But
I didn't like the first rifle. I'll reach across and grab that one. That's a much better feel.
I wanted him to grab that one. I wanted him to push past the weapon and go for like some biscuits or something.
Just pour a drink.
Yeah, bit of a Yogi Bear move sort of a thing.
But in bringing up sort of some bigger ideas and some bigger conflicts, much like they did in Creature from the Black Lagoon, where it got quite scientific, it was a different kind of Hammer film.
Yeah, like this one was almost more philosophical at times, where they're talking about, you know, well, do these creatures have as much right as us to be here? Are they pretty much just waiting for us to die off so they get their turn sort of thing? And you kind of did sort of bring up the question, well, who's the real monster? And
which is great.
I think that's great,
And a higher level of intelligence as well, an ability above humans.
Exactly.
You know, a new evolution
of
man. They almost like an alien type thing that you see a lot in alien films. Mm. Where the alien creatures obviously can communicate telepathically, and this is all going on. And
that's right, in this weird in those days. Movie.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Amazing. Right. It is. Yeah. And you're right, because he even sort of said, what if we're the Neanderthals and it's the higher level being, you know?
There are some fascinating ideas in it, and one of them is sort of that idea that there are species perhaps that are waiting to outlive humans. Mm. Humans can fuck up the world. We'll wait up here, you know, in these, back then particularly, uninhabitable part of the world or whatever, and they're just kind of waiting it out. And it's—I don't know—it's interesting to see the characters in it. If any of them do come to terms with that, start to grapple with that, and I think that John Rollis and Peter Cushing's character sort of has a bit of a handle on that, whereas the others are kind of just—they're
a bit oblivious.
They're either driven by greed, like our mate Tom Friend, or the others who we just don't really know what the fuck's
like,
going on.
I'm good at taking photos. Yeah, but you're climbing a mountain to death. Like, what are you doing?
And he's really happy to just like bring up like, oh, I actually paid to come on this trip. And it's like, they never really do anything with that.
No, they really
do. Does he then get his foot snared?
Yeah, he's only gets his foot. Yeah, McNair, yeah.
It was just like kind of like, we need an extra person that's going to die at some point.
Pretty much.
Okay, he'll do.
Yes.
You need some bodies.
No backstory required.
Don't worry about a backstory.
It's annoying. Give him a camera. That'll do.
That'll do. That's his whole story.
It's annoying when they hint at the backstory and then like don't do it.
Yeah.
They just don't follow through on it. It's a bit frustrating. I do like how they, for a movie called The Abominable Snowman, we don't see the snowman basically until the final scene.
Yeah, literally just that one shot.
Yeah, yeah. Probably because it was too expensive.
Yeah.
It was probably more to do with the cost than like a filmmaking decision.
Yeah. And it was interesting because like they'd built up about, oh, its face and it's actually like, hold on, what if it's a greater being? So it wasn't, again, it lost the horror by the time we saw it. Like, I don't think when we see the face, it's actually meant to be scary at that point. It's meant to be a bit of a sort of, are we seeing a higher level being? Is it like man looking at God sort of thing? And then, of course, he passes out and then they're away.
Yeah.
It's quite a beautiful thing, you know, in a way. And I'd be interested to know.
Definitely not standard horror, though.
Definitely not standard horror, exactly, which is interesting because it is, Hammer Horror is one of their early ones. Mm. But I'd be interested to know what movies it has influenced, even though it's sort of this lesser-known movie.
Well, I mean, I read like a thing where it's like it was a clear influence for Blair Witch Project, just that sort of haunting. And obviously, again, with these films, they're probably more haunting and more horrific back in the 50s rather than by today's standards. But that moment, you know, where they're hearing voices and they're going out into the night and like there's a bit in Blair Witch where they're calling out to their friends in the darkness and they don't know what's happening. Stuff like that, I guess. It's so weird because it's such a wide open set. You know, you're in these mountain ranges and yet it's quite a claustrophobic sort of isolated feeling.
And especially once the snowstorm comes in.
Yeah, which is actually I didn't mind those scenes. Mm. And I particularly like Tom Friend watching the avalanche come at him.
That was the best scene of the movie. Yeah,
it was good. He's good when he's not talking.
When he's not talking, yeah. But the look on his face, he's just like, he just accepted it as the bit of the, I brought this on myself kind of a look.
Which is beautiful, which is what you want. He had like a decent character arc.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah, he really did.
Shame not Mel, no one else. No one else did. Helen's was okay.
She was.
She started out as, you know, the typical woman in the 50s who, like, they didn't let her do anything and she had to make them dinner and stuff. But then she got out there and saved the day, essentially. Yeah,
she did. And that's what I liked, because I was watching it thinking, oh, this is, you know, it's that 50s movie where, like, are they aware how condescending they're being to the female character? And it's like, well, what did you bring your wife up here for? She's a woman, you know.
Yeah.
But then ultimately, yeah, she's like, well, screw this. If they're in danger, I'm going to go save them.
Yeah.
And does, basically. Yeah.
She was good. Yeah, I liked her character. Yeah. I don't think that actress did much after this film.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's a shame, because she was all right.
Yep.
And Peter Cushing, obviously, is just the standout. But
yeah.
Yeah. He's great. He's great I will watch these other Hammer films just purely to watch him. I think we need a
movie night.
He is fantastic.
Smash through a few of them.
Yeah, I'm down for that. Shall I jump in a bit on this?
I'm pretty excited.
What I'm going to do is pitch a sequel. Like, we've just talked about things that needed fixing and that sort of thing. But I actually, my sequel came about in a weird way. It's because I looked at Peter Cushing on screen and I went, you know what? You look so much like Charles Dance from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
He
does.
And I was like,
you mention it.
And I was like, Peter Cushing, when they filmed the movie, was, you know, in his 40s. Mm. Charles Dance is about 70 now. So I was kind of like, what could I do with a sequel set 30 years later using the same character? So Charles Dance playing Dr. John Rollison.
Great.
Yeah.
And let's just dive in and see where it goes.
Hold on. Are we keeping Abominable?
No, see, I just want to call it The Snowmen.
Okay.
Which I know is tricky because Fassbender's got a movie at the moment called The Snowman.
Right.
But I feel like that movie is getting panned and is so shit that people will forget that it existed. And by the time Hollywood catches onto this and makes this one, maybe we can get away with it.
We're all in the money.
I just like it.
The other thing is,
You are.
I was thinking, because you brought it up before, I'm like, I don't think anyone ever uses the word abominable other than in relation to The Snowman.
I'll tell you what, it's one of those words where you have to pause just for a brief second before you say it to make sure that you nail it. Yeah. Like,
and I usually don't.
Abominable. See, I don't even. Yeah. It's tricky. It's tricky.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you've ever been to the cinema and there's a really weird titled movie and you just look for the shortest possible version of it to buy your ticket, and sometimes they still hassle you and go, sorry, which one? And you have to say the whole fucking thing.
You sort of like mumble it out at them. Yeah.
The Abominable Snowman. Yeah, I'll just call it The Snowmen.
Cool. Great.
Loving
it.
Nice.
So we open on an updated Hammer Films logo. Think of, you know, the Marvel logo where they have the comic book characters coming in through the words, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But we'll do it, you know, Hammer style. So there's Frankenstein, the Mummy, Dracula. Finally, the Abominable Snowman with the final few beats of it showing characters from the 1950s film. Nice. Like Foxy.
Foxy.
So that fades into a that fades into a black and white landscape. We see mountains. And then closer in, snow. It stretches for miles and miles and we follow it. In time, we reach an icy clearing. We see a small row of freshly dug graves. Wooden crosses mark each of them. These are the graves of the characters in the 50s film. We see Tom Friend, Ed Shelley, Andy McNee. We linger for a moment, and then we turn our attention to what rests behind them. A cave. We go into the cave and we see Dr. John Rollison, as he was played by Peter Cushing. We might have to do a little bit of effects here, but Star Wars Rogue One pulled it off.
Yeah.
So let's just go with that.
Yeah, bring it on.
The shadows of the creatures line the walls around him, and as happened in the film, we close in on his face as he looks at the Yeti, and then the words he said to the llama after, along the lines of, there was nothing there, there is no creature, play, as he locks eyes with the abominable snowman. We go from Peter Cushing's black and white face in the 50s to 30 years later, and now in colour, the same expression, the same character, only now John Rollison is played by Charles Dance.
Nice.
We move out from Rollison's face and see that he is seated in a car. His face is grim. We now see that he sits across the road from a hospital. He gets out of his car just as it starts to rain. But rather than hurry along, he takes his time and is soaked. He walks along a corridor and is greeted by a doctor. He gets an update on his wife's condition. And we can see her resting in a bed. She's not doing very well. The doctor tentatively brings up a few suggestions for other care facilities, ones that are cheaper and a little more in their price range. Basically, they're going to have to move her very soon. Rollison gets rid of the doctor and he musters a smile as he enters the room and speaks with his wife, Helen. She asks if their friend Foxy is coming soon. Awesome. Rollison avoids the question, knowing that Foxy died years ago.
Oh.
They are interrupted by a man, a uniformed soldier. His name is Colonel Anderson. Anderson needs Rollison's help on a mission into the mountains. You see, the villagers have been terrorized, destroyed, and people killed by creatures in the night. Rollison asks what the hell that has to do with him. Anderson throws down photographs on the table. Rollison looks through them. Houses destroyed, fires, blood, dead bodies, and finally, footprints in the snow. Giant footprints.
Here we go.
Rollison shakes his head and says, "The amount of people who have come to ask me about this sort of thing, for years, my answer is the same. I never found a damned Yeti in the mountains. I cannot help." "Oh, really?" says Anderson. "You want to tell me what happened to the rest of your team then? How they died? Tom Friend, Ed Shelley, Andrew McNee? Do these names mean anything to you?"
"Ooh."
And he says, "They mean a great deal to me. People go mad in the mountains. Any other theories are illogical and I can't help you." Anderson explains another theory he has, that people have speculated about the powers of the Yetis and that perhaps his mind was wiped or controlled. Rollison fires back saying that if that were true and his mind was controlled, then he's hardly a reliable sort to take on a mission like this. But Anderson needs him because Rollison has a relationship with the Lama, with the German Lama of the Tibetan of the Tibetan monastery that blocks the pass into the mountains.
He speaks German.
And they require his blessing to pass through on their way to fighting the creatures. They need his help.
So is the Lama still alive?
Yeah, I'm gonna use him. I did look at the film and go, shit, how old do you reckon that guy is? But if he was about 60 in the film, about 90.
No, I like it. Because you've got this really tiny, wizened Lama, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Rollison may not remember the Yeti, but he still remembers the path to the graves and the cave, and once they find those, they can track the beasts. Rollison's still not interested, so Anderson points out the window and he says, "There's two helicopters out there. One of them takes us to the Himalayas, and the other one takes your wife here to the best government hospital we have, where she'll get all the treatment she needs day and night."
Oh, brilliant.
Oh.
Rollison thinks of Helen and how little money they have, and he doesn't have a choice. He accepts, but he looks at the colonel and he says, "Whatever is killing these people, whatever these creatures are, you mean to destroy them, yes? Destroy or drive away, help people, not lock them in a cage to study." Anderson grins and says, "Dr. Rollison, you don't have to worry. Our only mission is to save the people." And that's when we get the title on screen and we'll just call it The Snowman.
Great. Mm. Well, mate, you're bringing the heart already.
Yeah.
Apparently in the first act.
Yeah. That's what was missing. Backstory. We've got the backstory. Yes. It's right here.
So they touch down in Tibet in the shadows of these great mountain peaks, and Rollison immediately gets to work and meets with the Lama, who is now very, very old. Like we said before, I imagine he's probably like 90. And if we could cast someone who isn't German, then that would be fantastic. The Lama says to him, "Last time, 30 years ago, I let you pass and men died. And for what? You were here to study. Tom Friend was here to profit from capturing a supposed monster." Rollison reaffirms that the soldiers are here to protect the villagers higher up in the mountains. The Lama asks if Rollison has remembered anything in the past 30 years, but Rollison brushes him off. "No," he says. "There is nothing out there, at least not what these men seek. Let them pass and help the villagers and see for themselves that it's a bear or some other wild animal, and then they'll leave." And the Lama reluctantly agrees. So the group set out, and I'm thinking like there's half a dozen soldiers, kind of like Marine types. You know, like in Aliens, you get the cocky and the boisterous grunts. They're all hauling guns and flamethrowers.
Yeah, if they're going up into that sort of extreme, you've got those guys like, bring it on.
Because we've seen horror films where you have perhaps a scientific team like in Creature go there and they're not prepared. They don't have weapons. But this team sort of knows what they're in for. It's a rescue mission, save the villagers. They've got their guns and shit ready.
Are they a bit trigger happy, these guys?
I think they would be.
Yeah.
I think they're those typical sort of, you know, it's Hudson from Aliens, Bill Paxton, you know.
Yeah.
Just want to fight anything and they don't give a shit what's coming.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah.
So the path that Ron's familiar to Rollison, he can at least remember that well enough. He's happy for a time to be back amongst the clean mountain air, but that happiness is short-lived. The higher they climb, the more villages they pass through and they see a wave of carnage, splattered blood, bodies in the streets, livestock gone, homes burnt out. Then they reach a village that's deserted. There are no bodies in the street, nothing on fire or smouldering. The animals are still locked up behind fences. Anderson and his men want to keep moving, but Rollison notices signs of a struggle. Scattered footprints in the snow. They investigate and they find a child. Her name is Netu and she's probably about 13 or 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
She's terrified, starving, her clothes are filthy. She's softly spoken, but she says that she's been hiding for days. She falls quiet before telling them that the rest of the village was taken. Anderson's now interested. He said, how many did they take? How many people are missing? She says about 20.
Wow.
And she shivers and says, it comes at night. Anderson refuses to waste a man by sending her back down to the monastery, so they must bring her along. Rollison takes it upon himself to watch over her, as the soldiers are too riled up and bloodthirsty to find the missing people and kill the snowmen. So they climb higher and the weather starts getting much, much worse. And the higher they go, the weirder things become.
How's it going with his leg?
Yeah, because they brought that up in the original, didn't they? That he had the leg problem.
Yeah.
I feel like they never really did anything with it, though, and he never actually seemed to have an issue.
No, he was doing better than the photographer.
Wasn't limping, no.
Yeah, he wasn't.
Just trekking up those Alps / Himalayas.
Yeah, so I feel like it's probably the kind of thing that we can ignore from the first one. Right. Although he's about 70 now.
Yeah,
so let's, you know, he's probably struggling a bit. You've got all these young, fit soldiers, and he's probably bringing up the rear with this kid who's terrified.
I would like it if this kid's scared, but she's sort of encouraging him.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
She's sort of pushing him along.
Yeah,
Or like she's ahead of him and he's like, I've got to keep fucking going to help her out and make sure she's okay because they don't give a shit. They've just got their guns out. And
motivation to get up there. Yeah, great.
Yeah, cool. So, you know, things are getting weirder the higher they climb. Like a soldier goes off to take a piss and he never returns. Another goes missing with no sign, no footprints, nothing. There are sounds in the night. The wind howls and perhaps other things do too. Whispers and voices carried on the air. Anxiety grows, rumors, tensions. Fear rises along with the altitude and the potential for madness starts to creep into their party. I like actually playing around with this because I do think sort of the further up you go in these situations, especially up in there when there's high altitude, it starts to play with your head a bit and you don't sleep properly anymore and it starts to kind of, you think you might have seen something and you're not quite sure.
And you can
like
get a bit giggly. You can almost get a bit of a high going sometimes.
Yeah, right.
So if you're in that state of mind with weird shit happening.
Yeah, that was in the original as well where it was just suggested and is it altitude that's causing...
Yeah,
To hear things, or is it the snowman?
Yeah. I kind of like that sort of ambiguousness of it.
Yes, yeah.
That's the word.
Yeah.
So not long after, two more men go missing. There's a trail of blood staining the snow, but it ends as abruptly as it began, and they have no answers still. It's here in the grip of darkness and fear that we learn a little bit more about Colonel Anderson. He stands on the perimeter with Rollison. He's pulling the trigger on his flamethrower every so often just to scare away any unwanted threats or to perhaps let people know where they are. So, guys, we've jumped 30 years, so we're in like probably 1980 or something like that.
Okay, yeah.
He explains that he served in Vietnam, a war where they went in unprepared into enemy terrain and ultimately paid a terrible price. It was an unwinnable situation, and for a man who needs to win at all costs, it was a position that he never wanted to be in again.
Ooh, yeah.
And then they handed him this shitty detail. But rather than complain and accept defeat, he would do what nobody thought possible. He would win. He looks down at the flamethrower in his hands and he shakes his head. He says, never thought I'd want to use one of these again. When I was over there, damn, first time I've seen napalm. Have you ever seen fire so hot it melts the faces off men? When I signed up, they don't tell you about that. They don't tell you about lifting a guy onto a stretcher, only for his melted skin to peel away as you touch him. But this fire here... in my hands. It's not for man. It's for those fuckers out there. He says, history repeats itself. Sometimes we learn, but that doesn't always mean the people we work for learn. Vietnam taught me an important lesson. You can't be the colonel who never loses a man, no matter how hard you try. Men will die. You make the best of what you have and complete the mission. And so they climb higher still and the weariness is growing now. Rollison bonds with the girl, Netu. She doesn't say much. He sits alone around the fire, cutting an apple with his knife. She approaches slowly and takes a seat near him. They sit in silence. He offers her a piece of apple, but she refuses. He reaches in his bag and takes out another apple. He offers it to her and she accepts. He cuts himself another piece and then hands her the knife. She cuts her own piece and then returns the knife. And they repeat this action as they both stare quietly into the flames. I kind of want, like, I needed a bonding scene between him and, you know, the child.
Yeah.
But it's like, I feel like a typical thing to do would be to have them sitting at the fire and her being like, oh, I miss my mum and dad and my family. I hope they're okay. Yeah. And him being like, oh, I miss my wife. I hope she's okay. And then...
That's what brings them together.
Yeah. I watched a film recently that had, for me, like the most beautiful scene in the film was when there was so much to be said between these two characters, but there was no dialogue.
Yeah.
And it was all just done between like their actions and the way they look at each other. So I kind of like the idea of him just sitting at the fire and passing a knife back and forth with this like 14-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And that's just how they bond.
Yeah, nothing being said.
Yeah.
Also like it because it's the opposite of what they did in the original where they said everything.
Now we are bonding.
And now I pass you the knife. Yes, cut a big piece. Thank you. So now we've got more soldiers who have disappeared. And Rollison, he's called on to, you know, help carry some of the equipment that those soldiers were. He's got to do a bit more now to sort of help out. And while he's doing this, he drops some of it onto the ground and it breaks open, revealing all sorts of tools. But they're tools that are designed specifically to capture the creatures.
Oh.
Anderson lied to him and they get into an argument. Anderson slams Rollison for his naivety. How could he be so foolish to think that they wouldn't study the creatures? Rollison is furious. He accuses the soldiers of putting the capture of the snowmen ahead of saving the villagers. Which strikes a nerve because it's true. And ultimately, Anderson doesn't really shy away from that. Rollison goes crazy. He says, I don't know what powers you think these snowmen have, but I can tell you that mind control isn't one of them. I never had my mind wiped. I was never controlled. I never forgot. I didn't forget a damn thing. I remember it all. I remember Tom going mad with fear and hunting the beast until he died. I remember the others picked off in the night. I remember our guide, Tusung, having the sense to run down the mountain and get as far away as he could. Most of all, I remember its face, staring at me for God knows how long. It's not a monster. There's something else, something higher, that'll outlast us. And there's not a gun, not a damn flamethrower in your possession that will make a difference.
Oh.
There's not enough of you for how many of them there are. I can't even guess how many. I never wanted them to be found. I never told anyone. I never told my wife. She found me, passed out in the snow, and I told her I never saw it. I looked her in the eyes and I lied to her, and I did again. Any other time it ever came up. I guess I felt like I was protecting her. I was stopping others from trying to find this place. I was stopping her from coming back. All I ever did was lie to the woman that I love. Anderson takes it all in and sits in silence for a moment before he asks, why did they let you go? I always thought it was because they knew I'd never come back, but now I'm back here and I did it for my wife because I was afraid. Fear dictates what we do. Rollison tells him that when the morning comes and the storm passes, he's taking the girl and going back down. The night passes, but the storm doesn't. Their way down is blocked, and the only way is up. Later in the day, Anderson gets a call on the radio, a call from home. Rollison's wife passed away in the night.
Oh.
Anderson makes camp and tells Rollison the news. Rollison nods his head slowly, takes it all in. He doesn't say a word. Once Anderson finishes, Rollison turns his back and walks away from the camp. He leaves their sight and sinks to his knees in the snow. With his trembling hands, he reaches into his jacket and withdraws a picture of Helen. He looks down on it as he tries to steady his hand. His shoulders shake, and he cries. Later, Rollison sits alone at the campfire. The soldiers man the perimeter, keen to be away from the grieving man and his feelings. Netu slowly approaches. She takes a seat next to him by the flames. She doesn't say a word. She just stares into the flames as he does. She reaches into her pocket, withdraws an apple and offers it to him.
You break my heart.
And he smiles.
Oh, got me right in the feelings. That's the one.
That's what we want.
Later, they're awoken by a commotion. Their camp has been ransacked, their equipment all destroyed, their tools gone. The only things that remain were what they had on their person. Probably like, you know, their guns and their flamethrowers and such.
Mm-hmm.
The radio is broken. They can't call for help. They're completely stranded and completely exposed. Rollison tells them that the cave beside the gravesite of his friends is a little further up the mountain. And they each light a flame from the fire because their torches have been, you know, destroyed or taken or whatever, and set off on the perilous path. Rollison's eyes linger on the grave markers of his fallen friends, but the cold makes him hurry along to the cave. Memories come rushing back as he enters. The net that they set for the Yeti still hangs, covered in cobwebs after 30 years.
Good one.
They all huddle inside for warmth. Rollison, Netu, Anderson, and the handful of remaining soldiers. They each hold a burning stick in their hands, the light from which barely lights half the cave. They huddle, terrified for hours. Nobody speaks. Even Anderson is too disturbed to formulate their next step. The only sound is the wind outside and the chattering of teeth. Rollison sits in silence, wondering how long it will take for the snowmen to find them. But then they hear a sound. They move their torches, cutting through the dark, but the cave is vast. They expect the shuffle of giant feet, the growl of a hungry monster, the wail of an angry snowman calling to his kind. But instead, the sound they hear from the darkness of the cave is... For one terrifying second, they look around at each other before the soldier closest to Rollison has the flaming stick ripped from his hand and stabbed through his back. The end of it ripping through his chest, stealing his life and extinguishing the flame. Those fastest to move rush for the cave exit, but in a whirl, their path is blocked by a flock of bats that swarm around their heads and tear at their skin. Their only choice is to run further into the cave, where a dark shape appears in front of them and lifts them off their feet. One of them watches his friend's neck being opened up as the blood sprays across his face. His fear only lasts a few moments longer as he too is drained from the neck before his forearms are sickeningly wrenched from their sockets.
Are you fast?
The remaining soldier bravely steps ahead of Anderson, but before he can put pressure down on the trigger of his gun, he cries out in pain as two forearm bones puncture his skin and he's pushed back into the cave wall, the force so strong that the bones splinter against rock. Anderson pulls the trigger on his gun and the cave erupts with a sound of gunfire. The dark shadow swirls and once more gone. Rollison screams at him to cease firing. The space is too confined. The bullets are just as likely to ricochet and hit them. So instead, he pulls the trigger on his flamethrower and lights up the cave with fire. He screams for the creature to show itself. He moves through the cave, lighting it up, but he doesn't see what creeps behind him. Dracula steps forward from the darkness and sinks his teeth into Anderson's neck.
Oh my God.
Anderson drops the flamethrower and tries to turn and face him, but Dracula throws him through the air. He hits his head on the rock, bleeding freely, but he still turns to face the vampire. He pulls a knife from his belt and says, "Come on, you son of a bitch, I'm not afraid of you."
No.
Holy shit.
Not of me, perhaps, but I think... you are afraid of the flames.
And Dracula picks up the flamethrower, puts his finger on the trigger, and looks down upon Anderson, whose eyes widen in fear as the flames engulf him and melt. He melts before their eyes.
Oh, shit.
Dracula turns away from the smoldering body and slowly walks towards Rollison and Netu, who sit huddled in the corner. He reaches out for the girl, but Rollison snarls at him to leave her alone. Dracula turns his attention to Rollison. He kneels in front of him and studies his face.
"These men in the cave, who would say they do not fear me? They lie. You fear me too, as you should. But with you, it is different. You've seen a monster. The look on your face is not one of surprise. No, it is more like acceptance. And there are more out there than you thought. You've seen the snowman."
"Yes, in this very cave, 30 years ago."
"What a fool you must be to come back here. Why did you?"
Rollison looks at the ground and says, "For my wife."
"How so?"
"She was sick. They offered to help her if I helped them."
"For her sake, I hope you were already paid."
"She's dead, so it hardly matters. It wasn't the snowmen who attacked those villagers, was it? It was you." Dracula nods. "What do you want? Why have you come here? Why are you hurting these people?"
"I can only fight against my nature for so long. I have been on this earth for, well, a very long time. But even I am only a drop in the ocean compared to these snowmen. So I search, and I find out what I can. And through all of that, across all these years, it has led me to here. I once came to these lands many years ago, but thought never to return. I want to know about the world. I found out everything I can, but my knowledge only goes back so far. The snowmen, only they can tell me how many centuries they have walked the earth and what they know."
"And you think they'll just be willing to give you this knowledge?"
"Perhaps not. But when you are not a slave to time, as I am, you can afford to go down the covered path. That has led me to here.
It is said, to drink the blood of the snowman is to see what they see. Now, if that is true or not, time will tell.
Then we are just obstacles in your way. Dracula nods. Rollison closes his eyes, accepting death. He says, do it then. I want to see my wife again. And Dracula smirks.
You believe in that? I expected a fight. For the girl's life, at least.
Rollison looks at her sadly and is ashamed of his selfishness. He thinks quickly. Take us with you. Both of us. You want something from the snowmen. And they might want us, seeing as they took the whole village. Dracula agrees to this. Rollison doesn't have a plan, but he thinks it might give him time to come up with one. The only thing that matters now is saving Netu. And so in the darkness, they hike further up, finally coming upon a snowman settlement. We see a handful of them, and they're huge. 9-foot-tall creatures with faces that are somewhere between apes and humans. Though we can see only a few of them, it is quite clear that there are shining eyes looking out from hiding spots across the clearing. So there's, you know, quite a few of these things. We see the people kidnapped from the village, but they are unhurt. They're actually fine. Netu rushes into the arms of her family. The leader of the snowmen steps forward. He looks vaguely familiar, and we may recognize him as the snowman from the end of the 1950s film.
Brilliant.
Nice.
He shares a knowing look with Rollison, but it's unclear what he's thinking. Is he angry that Rollison has returned? But then he hears a voice. It's the snowman leader's voice, but his mouth doesn't move, and no one else seems to be hearing it. It's only for him. It says, never saw you coming back, but here you are. I didn't want to, says Rollison aloud, and everybody looks at him. We took the villagers to keep them safe, says the leader. Safe from it. Points at Dracula, who steps forward and pleads his case for sharing in their knowledge. He even offers up Rollison and the girl, a foolish move. The leader forbids it, and he speaks directly to Dracula. You are unlike us. It is true. You are unlike any. And that is a good thing. We care about the way the world is, how it is left, how it will be. We come here to wait. We have patience. We are not you and never will be. We do not deal in pain and anger and destructive violence. You are an abomination.
Oh, yes.
And you are all pathetic and weak. This world you are in, these mountains you cower behind, they are castles in the sand that will blow away in time. You think you are going to wait patiently and outlive the humans? That world, the world you long for centuries from now, that is a world that will still have me in it.
Oh, yes.
No, it won't, poor creature. For without the humans, there will be nothing left for you to leech off.
There will always be something. I will always find a way.
That's why some of us have to suffer forever. Dracula clenches his fists in fury and charges at the leader. When he is inches from his face, his form changes into a sea of bats that swarm at the leader, though he gently swats them away. Dracula targets some of the weaker-looking snowmen as a vicious fight ensues. They may be a peaceful creature, but when provoked, they are terrifying to behold.
It's a showdown.
The leader puts his hands into the snow and roars against the wind. Snow changes direction midair and hammers down into the bats, stunting their flight path and sending them crashing to the ground. In their place, Dracula's form once again appears. He charges at the leader, who still keeps his hand on the ground, and roars once more. The ice around him cracks and opens wide into a crevasse that widens until it meets an unsuspecting Dracula, and he plummets down into the darkness. The leader removes his hand from the ground, and the furious look on his face is replaced by once more by calmness. He turns to face Rollison and the others, but doesn't notice the bats that spew from the crevasse by the hundreds and take shape behind him in the form of Dracula, who buries his teeth into the leader's neck and drinks his blood. The leader pushes him away and staggers backwards, but steadies himself. Dracula stands before all, savoring the taste on the tip of his tongue. He smiles triumphantly and waits for the effect, but what he gets is not the one he expects. He staggers forwards, his vision blurred. And then he vomits blood. He spews it up all over the snow and falls to his knees.
What is happening to me?
We are unlike the humans. Our blood is poison to you. What you came here for is a waste. But we cannot let you harm anymore. They move in on him, but Rollison steps between them and Dracula. He looks down on the vampire with almost pity, like a wounded animal. Rollison says, it's a cycle of violence, and we'd be no better than him. He's a crawling animal. He turns to Dracula. We don't get to have all the answers. That's what makes us human. We try, we fail, and we try again. There are no shortcuts when it comes to life, but you're not alive. You don't even understand the pain you inflict on others, because you don't know how it feels anymore. The pain you have, the pain you carry, was so long ago, and now you feel nothing. Dracula looks up at him slowly and says,
I feel it. I still feel it.
The leader bids him leave, or he can wait a while longer for the sun if he chooses. Dracula vanishes from their sight, and the snowmen bid them farewell to return to their lives and leave the snowmen to their own. Later, when they make their way slowly down the mountain, Rollison trails behind Netu and her family. She looks back at him and smiles, and he returns it. Then he hears a voice in his head, but soon realizes that it is in his head. How else could he be hearing the voice of his dead wife? She calls to him, and against his better judgment, he follows. Happy to hear her once more, he finds himself separated from the villagers and off the path and into a clearing. A figure walks out from behind a rock. The figure is Dracula. He limps in a weakened state, and Rollison says, get out of my head.
Is it not nice to hear her once more? In the cave, you were afraid, but not of me. No, you were afraid that she was gone and you were alone. Your Helen. Do you think it is possible that you will see her again?
Rollison looks at him and says, I hope so. Dracula slowly walks towards him, understanding and pain in his eyes. Rollison's eyes are the same. Dracula reaches out and gently takes a hold of Rollison's neck and looks at him one last time. Rollison nods, and Dracula sinks his teeth into his neck again and again and again.
Fucking hell.
Rollison drops to the ground as Dracula slowly walks away and stands at the edge of the cliff. He looks out at the sky as the last pieces of darkness disappear, readying for the morning sun. And for a moment, he doesn't move. He merely thinks about a person. Only one person, and her smile. But then he vanishes to find shelter from the light. Rollison lays in the snow, not feeling the chill. His blood leaks from his wounds and stains the snow in all directions. The morning sun breaks through and lights his face. He closes his weary eyes. He thinks of Helen, and he smiles. The end.
Yes! Oh my God.
Woo.
Yes!
Holy shit.
So that's the snowmen.
Mate.
Sorry for keeping you in the dark about what was going to happen.
Fucking year.
I got to say like a huge thanks to Greg, because Greg just got here just a little bit before recording and I just sort of shoved this in his face and was like, do you mind reading some words here? So,
I'm giddy.
I figure when you got
have my own private performance. That was friggin' amazing.
I figure when you've got Dracula in the building, you kind of got to... I did say to Damo very cryptically, I'm like, oh, you know, we've got Greg, who's a great actor, so I'll probably give him a voice
Throw
or two
in.
To do, you know?
Yeah, I didn't think anything... But, my God.
Fuck, yeah.
You got me good, mate. You got me good, you bastard.
Good, good.
Oh, look, that's up there as one of your best yet.
Thank you, sir.
I think you've outdone yourself.
I had a lot of fun.
I mean, you and Dracula... Oh, it just comes out so well. Holy shit.
It's very fun to write. And I mean, it's I got to pay a lot of credit to Greg, because it's quite easy when I hear Greg's voice in my head.
Yeah.
And it's like I can just kind of like spit out some dialogue. And the beauty of it is that Greg's so good that he kind of makes anything you write sound pretty good. So cheers, mate.
Oh,
but my approach was kind of similar when we talked about Creature last week. We were like, when we talked about doing classic horror pictures or something, you just kind of picked the film and you hadn't seen it yet. And I hadn't seen The Abominable Snowman. I just assumed I'd like it because it was about snowmen in the mountains. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, oh, cool.
Yeah, I love the mountains. Yeah. Yeah.
I had like an epiphany about a week ago where I was like, what if I put Dracula in?
Yeah.
Well, it was around the time when we were kind of like, oh, let's maybe get like a guest in or someone. I thought Greg would be really good. And I thought, hang on, I've got Greg. Oh, like try something.
I've got Dracula.
So yeah, it was fun.
Oh, nice.
I'll tell you the bit in it that I was most excited when I came up with it. It was when I decided to use the flamethrower on Anderson.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, and then what if I go back and put like a story about how he didn't, he hated watching people get burned. Oh.
Yeah. Like the beautiful tragedy of it all is, oh, delicious.
And then Dracula's just quite happy to use that against him.
Yeah, of course he is. Oh, and then my heart breaks at the bloody end. Oh, man.
Well, I just figured he's lost his wife.
That was good.
And for him, it's kind of like, it's acceptance. It's and I'm playing at the thing that Dracula can obviously get inside people's heads. And he's seen that. He knows in the cave, Dracula was trying to scare him, but really he saw that the fear was to do with the wife and that sort of thing. And I really love that the hook for Dracula was that sort of offhand mention of kill me so I can see my wife.
Right.
In, you know, in the afterlife or whatever's beyond. And Dracula's kind of like dismissive at first, but then later, that's what pulls him back in because he's kind of like, because obviously
Dracula, he can't help but relate to that.
Has that thing in his past that's, you know, been a weight on him.
He's not able to do.
Right.
Exactly.
He's able to allow that for a human to feel that, but Dracula can't do that. So that's the one thing that.
Yeah. And so it's almost like an act of compassion when he kills him.
Well, it's kind of, it's kind of what Greg just said. It's like Dracula. He's probably too afraid to, like, I mean, he stands on the cliff at the end and he could quite easily just stay there and the sun could come up and he could find out what happens beyond as Rollison is. But for him, it's kind of like, I actually can't do that.
Yeah.
I can't accept that. I'm not at a point yet where I can he's not brave enough to do it.
No, he's almost, but he's almost like, lived too long at this point to be able to accept
it. He's like, if I can help this man do it, then okay, that's maybe some little glimmer that I can, some small kindness that I can do.
Yeah. That was great, right?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I loved your snowmen. Yeah, they weren't like, I mean, I loved, as soon as there was a showdown, I was all in.
Yeah, and how powerful they are
And how powerful they are. That's it. They can be scary.
Yep.
If they can take on Dracula and win, and then, when he drank their blood, but it didn't go the way he thought it was going to go. Yeah. Oh, mate.
Yeah.
That was just like me scribbling in my notebook and being like, oh, what can I do? What can I do? Because I was kind of like, I had the idea of using Dracula in the cave. I've had an idea for a while of wanting a scene in something that has like a Dracula crossover.
Yes.
Where from the darkness, you hear that whistle and you go, oh, fucking hell, he's in there.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is kind of the perfect moment to do it. And then I was like, but then I need to kind of be like, what does Dracula want?
Right.
But I think it's natural for him because he's been around for centuries. And then if the snowmen have as well, it's kind of like, let's share some knowledge. I want to know what the deal is.
Yeah.
I want to know everything I can.
No, it's a super strong motivation that so totally suits his character, because what else has he got but time? Why wouldn't he go find out some stuff?
Yeah, and why wouldn't he want to know? If they know something, maybe they know how Dracula can get back to his lost love.
Exactly.
That's it, yeah.
That's the only thing that keeps driving him. He keeps thinking she's going to get reborn. Or someone else, she's going to have that same connection with someone else. It never comes.
Yeah.
But the snowmen, they've got the answer.
I kind of do. Like, you get the sense that, they are this next level being.
Yeah, I don't think about what they know too much, but if you do, you're probably like, I'm sure they know everything.
Well, you think if it's that whole mystical thing, isn't it? It's like, what do they know? Well, they probably know everything.
Yeah, exactly.
But I like
that'll do.
But I like that we never know.
No. Because we're not meant to. It's like, I don't know.
It's cool to play around with like their powers too. Because I thought, I didn't want to go too much into it earlier with the whole. Because in the film, they imply that Rollison's mind got wiped or whatever. Whereas when I watched it, I got to the end of the 50s film and I went, no, I thought it was an active choice of him being like, I've met them, I've seen them, and I'm choosing to tell people there's nothing there to stop more people from going
right.
there.
I've seen what happens when people go after them.
In that final scene where he meets them, do you think that they're communicating, and in that communication there's some agreement that, look, don't tell the world that we're here? And then they let him go.
I think so.
That's interesting. Yeah, because I took it the other way, that they'd kind of just wiped his mind.
Right, yeah, like, yeah.
That's because the movie's a little bit ambiguous.
Oh, completely.
So I went to the Wikipedia and I was like, and then it says in the Wikipedia, so the official line is that they wiped his memory. And I'm kind of like, that's not the read I got, though.
Not at all.
I'd much prefer your take on it, because then he's an active character, and he actively chooses it. I love it.
And just especially with him having to like lie to his wife. That's brilliant.
So for 30 years, he's kind of carried this, and he's probably, like everybody thinks, oh, he just forgot. Like, I'm curious to know what he said to people, you know, what happened up there. I'm assuming
that makes the look on the German lama's face even more telling, because then I just took that as to be, there is nothing up there.
Well, I took it that the German lama was kind of like, very good. We all pretend there's nothing there to protect them, and the world is in balance.
Yeah,
and
that's
exactly
what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Do you have a cast for Anderson?
Oh, shit. I didn't even think of that. That's so funny.
When you gave his backstory is brilliant.
Yeah.
Because his motivation's so strong. Cool. I was really on board with that. And especially that timeline. You're like, of course he's a vet. Of course he's a Vietnam vet.
Who'd you see?
Yeah.
Who did I see? I didn't really see anyone, to be honest.
I saw Mel Gibson.
Oh. Yeah. Pretty good.
As you were saying it, I'm like, boom.
Yeah. I could see that.
That's funny, because I didn't think about an actor for it, but when I was thinking about the character, the movie that I was thinking about was We Were Soldiers. Mel Gibson.
Yeah, completely.
Just that whole thing about, because he plays, I think, Lieutenant Hal Moore in that film, and his whole line is, men will die, and they have to accept it and move on. Yeah. But he's also the lieutenant who was kind of like, we won't leave anybody's behind thing. I actually quite like that film. Yeah, Mel Gibson would be good. Mm. My mind sort of wanders to like Russell Crowe or something like that. Yeah.
When does your mind not wander to Russell Crowe?
Rusty could do it. Yeah.
But you probably want someone who's about, you know, 40s, 50s. Oh, Mel Gibson's a bit older than that now. Mm. He's probably nearly 70, isn't he, Mel Gibson?
Yeah,
he's still got it though.
Yeah, but yeah, he could work. He'd be a hard man, wouldn't he? Like that character.
Yeah,
and that's the interesting thing about his character. Obviously, he cares about his men living.
Yeah,
as much as he's sort of some men will die, but he doesn't give a shit about the villagers.
No, he's there. Like, I mean, I could have played more with the whole idea of his mission is probably go there, capture one, bring them back. Because I'm assuming that the government have potentially heard the same thing that Dracula has, and it's like, if we can.
Yeah.
Get the blood and experiment, and maybe we can learn secrets, because knowledge is power, and we want to win the next war that happens so we don't fuck it up again. And
We can control the ISIS or whatever. As the American military always do. They always it's either the military or the FBI that just screw everything up completely.
That's it.
But I don't know. That's my take on
that twist,
on the snowmen.
Oh, you got me.
Nice.
You son of a bitch.
Thank you, boys. Cheers.
Yeah.
And on that note, I've been Carney.
I've been Damien.
I've been Greg.
And if you have any thoughts about the abominable snowman or anything you want to see, or who we should cast as Anderson, if not Mel Gibson or Rusty Crowe, you can hit us up at mmsandspants@gmail.com or on Twitter at mmsandspants, or you can find us individually. I'm at Sidekick of Dowie.
I'm at Midday Pajamas.
Greg, I'm not on Twitter.
Not on Twitter. Yeah. Oh, we have a live show coming up in Sydney on November the 16th at the place that's called, I think, Knox Street Bar or something like that. Yeah,
that sounds all right.
Nice.
I think it's in Chippendale.
Oh, mate, your memory is amazing.
Chippendale's a lovely place.
We'll put we'll put it in the show notes where you can find tickets for that. And Greg, have you got anything coming up?
I've got a play called The Commune. It's on in Melbourne at Voltaire. Opens November 15th. Come and see it if you're in Melbourne.
Beautiful. Oh, yeah. Okay. Definitely will. Written by Gabe Bergmosa.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
Who's he?
He's a young playwright.
He's an up-and-comer.
A bit wet behind the ears, but he's a quality young lad.
Right. He's done a couple of plays, apparently.
Okay.
All right, thanks, guys. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support the show, why not become a member at sanspantsplus.com and get early access to our shows, a bunch of exclusive content, and much, much more. That's sanspantsplus.com.